question, does everybody want to do the overview of the articles? I didn't get a chance to see how many readers we had or not. Doesn't matter. Happy to do it if that's helpful. Good. All right, we're going to go ahead and go through that then. So how we start is we have the articles, and so I'm going to spend about 3 to 5 minutes just going over a quick overview of what those articles are. And then from there, we'll have a poll to determine which one to discuss. So that'll be the order of events here. So, all right, so our theme this time was storytelling. Our first article was 5 types of stories that leaders need to tell. And his point there was when you share a story, you share a piece of yourself. So he typed them into various things that you can do and how effective they've been or not been. And then what that put me in mind of, and I'm going to pop it in the chat right now, is I don't know if any of you ever saw this, but Kurt Vonnegut did the same thing, only a slightly more humorous take on that. So I'm going to add that in there for anybody to look at that is interested. But it made me think of that pretty much immediately. And then let's see, then the next one was, oops, I lost my notes here. 1 second. Forgive me. The next one was how to dismantle hierarchies and teams. That was a podcast. He's also got a journal article, and I got the link for that as well. I'll put that in too if anybody has any interest in that. But his point was that it's hard to go back and forth between a hierarchy and a flatter structure to adjust. And so he came up with a couple tips around what he called bounding guidelines and grounding guidelines for decentralized teams. And I will get the link to his article as well. Let's see, where is it? There it is. Yeah, decentralization. Okay, so this is the link to his popping this in here also, if that's helpful, to the article that kind of supports that podcast that I went and got. And then the next one after that was there you go. Next one after that was design thinking in your organization. And so those authors went through and offered up a couple tools to compare design thinking to manage what they called managerial thinking, a more traditional focus on metrics and that sort of thing. And then they had another tool around assessing readiness of the organization to be receptive to design thinking. And they had some tips around what actions to take based upon the results of those assessments. So that was, can design thinking succeed in your organization? And then nice blast we haven't had in a while from Naomi Stanford's blog. And it looks like it was published 4 or 5 years ago, but she had some helpful links in there around where storytelling might be helpful in design. And she kind of brought that together. So it was a nice counterpart to the first article around the different types of stories. So she's got some specific links in there and perspectives. One was a humorous one too, kind of a, like a satire. And then the last one is Nikolai Warren, Are Flat Organizations More Human? And he made the point in there that you could think of, rather than thinking of middle managers as bottlenecks or problems with connecting, think of them as an opportunity to escalate. Was so he offered a reframing there around bringing two teams together and thinking about when you're trying to work on hierarchies versus flatter organizations. So that was our summary, basically, and hope that was helpful. And next thing we're going to do is poll. And our question for you is what prompted a reaction for you? Could be a positive or a negative. I mean, what gave you, food for thought? That you'd like to talk about. And what we're going to do with the results of the poll is order the discussion of the articles. So thank you for voting. Thanks, Tanya. And hi to the new joiners while I was talking, wasn't paying attention. Nice to have you.
Got a tie here. Give it just 4 more seconds to give you a full 30 seconds to vote. Looks like we're going to end in a tie.
All right, what do we got here? We've got design thinking and dismantling hierarchies. Okay. All right, let's just go right in order. Let's do the dismantle hierarchies. That was the in-seat article, the link. I put the supporting one as the second link in the chat, and then of course you haven't had time to read it, but and then it was talking about bounding and grounding guidelines. So can someone who voted for that one start us off and tell us what you thought was provoking about that article or that podcast rather? I didn't vote for it. I'd be happy to start. I was in one of the other columns, so thank you for someone who had that one as their top one. Thanks, Mark.
I think just right off the bat, just the title, "How to Dismantle," immediately kind of triggered. Okay, is this there an assumption that you should dismantle or not have hierarchy? So that was an immediate reaction versus just thinking about it a little bit broader. And then the term centralization, decentralization always triggers some reactions with me and how people interpret that and relate it to power and whatnot. So that's why I chose that.
Did you find anything in it you thought was applicable or useful, or I mean, what would you take forward from it?
I thought when they talked about the conscious choices of power, that was pretty useful. I think there's some questions about where they seem to go and emphasize more of hierarchy as driving centralization, if you will, or control. And if that's really all there is to it, I think there's a lot more to that. You can have, I think, a hierarchical organization that's not so centralized. So I think there's some stuff to play with there. I thought overall the PowerPoint was good.
PowerPoint, thank you. Power space point. Yeah.
PowerPoint. The point about power.
Yeah. I realized as soon as I said it, that didn't come out right. Someone else have something to add?
Jim has his hand up.
Yeah,
Who does?
I
Oh,
can
go ahead.
add in there. Having done this work, I was actually collaborating with a colleague of Michael Lee's, a fellow named Yves Dos at INSEAD, and on just this topic a number of years ago. And the boundaries are extremely powerful. However, they are very difficult to get top-tier leaders to agree on. So it's a major challenge to just get the top tier to establish what the boundaries are and where to put them and who to assign them to. It gets very messy. What happens is that the lower echelon leaders and individuals, when they escalate a question or escalate a decision, they typically find that has to go all the way to the top to get resolved. There isn't an intermediate layer that's empowered to make those decisions. But there are a couple of tools that are helpful. Everybody familiar with SCARF? SCARF. That's useful. And there's another one that is sort of bizarre, and it has to do with cybersecurity called STRIDE. And this came up in one company where people were assuming the credentials of other people so that they could make decisions. And it's sort of the same effect as cybercrime. So they steal the social identity and the status characteristics of somebody, and then all of a sudden they become the expert that everyone goes to. It reminds me of as a kid doing answer shopping between mom and dad.
So I've not heard of STRIDE, heard of SCARF. So how do you assume someone else's identity? How does that actually work out in practice? This is interesting.
Most of it is just through conversation and their participation on teams is they become a go-to person to ask to move the decision to. And then using the tool RAPID for decision making, many people are familiar with that, RAPID. So they just assume that decider position in making team decisions. And It really breaks down the trust in the delegation of authority, decision authority.
So reflecting that back, they're asking for forgiveness rather than permission
Yeah.
in the absence of structure.
Yeah, in the absence of structure. And we design these organizations as networks of self-organizing teams, but not self-managed. They are directed self-organizing teams with a hierarchical backbone. And the trick that we came up with was to start at the top and provide the leaders with an information base of decision criteria, decision principles, and facts. Like, these are our target customers. We only design products for these customers. It takes a lot of having those kinds of things, that kinds of data available to leaders at all levels, is an accelerator that sort of gets it, comes up, and avoids the issues that Scribe describes.
Is this back to what you were saying about because you were talking about how hard it is to get ranges? So I'm assuming the observation there is there's a lack of trust. And so I think what to reflect back what you just said, it's getting the information available and transparent helps mitigate the lack of trust that causes the complication in defining the ranges.
Yes, and the ranges, as it were, the decision criteria, as it were, are more, it's more about the top team agreeing on what they are than it is about actually applying them once you get them.
They're
So you end
deeming.
up with the top team leaders, one wants to be the lowest cost provider, the other one wants to be the premium supplier. And so they go off and they design their own parts of the organization against those criteria, or they behaviorally adjust the definition of the organization, the design of the organization.
Thank you. Jardina, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I think there were two things he talked about in the podcast that were, I listened to part of it, not all of it, but that were interesting because we do. I mean, we always talk about psychological safety and threat and SCARF and all these things, but he actually added two dimensions, one structural, one behavioral. So structurally, well, I don't know if he talked about this in the podcast actually, but anyway, structurally, sometimes the problem with hierarchy or the reason that we default to hierarchy is because of breadth, how you say it, right? Like, everybody just doesn't have enough of the whole picture to be able to make a decision across. So that's why it goes up the hierarchy, because until it gets to that person that has oversight across the board, no one can make the decision, right? So that those things, that's why he talks about grounded, because there needs to be someone who has the vision to be able to see everything to make the decision. And then the other thing he talks about is behaviorally, is that we're used to hierarchy. He talks about that, you in school you have a hierarchy, in your family you have a hierarchy, and people are just used to it. So that's why he talks about bounded. So if you can have bound authority where I know, like, in what cases I don't have to go up, I can maybe sometimes not default to hierarchy. So I thought those were two interesting things to think about from a design perspective. That's not only about our psychological safety.
Anyone else have anything? Thank you for that. Anyone have anything else to add on that?
Larry has his hand up.
Oh, sorry, didn't see it. Go ahead, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you. So I want to go back to Mark's comment. I appreciate what he said. The first place, the word dismantle probably has some emotional attachment or significance for all of us, like, oh, we got to dismantle something. And that may be seen as something negative or bad or whatever. And it's okay to talk about dismantling the hierarchy, but you got to have something in its place. You can't just dismantle something and then have chaos. So what are you going to replace that with? Is there going to be self-directed work teams? Is there going to be a democracy? What are you going to replace that with? And are people prepared and trained enough to operate in that new model? So it's one thing to talk about dismantling the hierarchy. And the hierarchy, like any other style, has its pros and cons. And so, again, maybe what Giardino was just saying, if there's a way we can take the things that are blocking us or impeding us in the design and change those so that we don't have to do that, then the hierarchy may be okay. It's just that we learn to operate in a modified hierarchy or in a participative hierarchy. So it's not just about dismantling it, it's about making sure it's aligned with the organization mission, vision, and values.
I'd add to that. My observation was when you start working on these things, there's a lot of people that have gone an entire career without really making decisions. You know, if you're in a hierarchy, I mean, you don't have a skill, the muscle's not there. So I wondered if anybody had a perspective on that. If it's better, like you said, the hierarchy is not so bad, that works, or if you know, able to move that development forward where the muscle to make decisions gets stronger.
Let me add to that. General Electric, and this is a way back. So in 1988 in Salisbury, North Carolina, they dropped their hierarchical model and went to self-directed work teams. And in a year, it failed miserably that they had to go back to the hierarchical model and then work to train their people how to operate in self-directed work teams. And then 3 years later, implemented it again, but it failed initially because the people weren't ready to take that responsibility. Just what you said.
There's
So
one
they just
other.
gave up. Thanks, Jim. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Ramona.
Oh, okay. All right then. Does anyone have anything else they want to add on that article? If
No,
Ramona did.
Ramona.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. Also, I don't know how well formed they are or rounded up, listening to you speaking as well. I think one of the important points in this podcast was the idea that self-management is hard. We are hardly wired socially or programmed to respond to authority, also because it makes it easier somehow. So the process of going flat brings challenges for the individual. Because self-management requires different layers of maturity, of self-understanding, and so on. And another challenge for the organization, and especially he talks about the leaders, how can I be of support while allowing for the space for freedom? And there are two other ideas associated with it, and I wasn't too sure what to make of them all together, because he says at some point, there's this idea that you need, in order to be free, you need to have clear boundaries, which is philosophical, and we could debate entirely just only on this. And another thing that he says, this idea that the perception of authority, so, and the informal types of mechanisms for authority, which is always interesting, I think, in a design process. How do people perceive that authority comes from where? And he says that in flat organizations, basically, this perception is linked to the fact that authority comes from the work that the people do, which I'm asking myself, is that associated then with competence? So I see people acting in a competent way, providing, I don't know, outcomes, results, creating new ways or innovating and so on. And that's where I place the authority, even if it's an informal type of authority. So these are kind of my ponderings. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else have anything you want to add on that? Otherwise, we'll move on to the next article.
Oh, I'll add something, Gina, if you don't
Sure.
mind. Ramona, I really loved what you were talking about. I think that the idea of self-management being hard, I also think it's very like personality dependent. I think that people thrive, that some certain types of people thrive in those types of environments, and some sorts of leaders can thrive. Like, I've kind of always run my organizations as like decentralized teams, even though they weren't technically decentralized. So I think that there's like a lot of nuance that is a little bit missed in the, like, you know, decentralized or centralized. And I think we're hitting on those themes a lot, but like, what's really the right answer? Cause I feel like decentralized could devolve into, like, you know, the Hunger Games and devalue like introverted leadership and these kinds of things that I think as designers, we're trying to pull out the best in all sorts of different kinds of people. So I don't know. I kind of feel like it's almost like it really needs to be like fit for purpose and fit for the place and fit for the mission of the company and fit for the size long before we can ever really say like, is decentralized better or is centralized better? And how do we put those together? So anyway, that just triggered my thoughts, what you were saying, Ramona.
And maybe a nice segue to the next article, because that's exactly what the he was kind of talking about, is assessing readiness, you know, before you
real quick, Gina, I think Carol, oh, yes. Carol has her hand up.
Oh, you did. I'm sorry, Carol. Okay.
No problem. And it's good to meet everybody and see everybody. Thank you for including me. The piece that I see that where companies often miss, I think, that I haven't heard talked about is the reward and risk dynamic in the culture. So companies create these hierarchies, as I've seen, in order to reward people as part of their reward system. And people don't want to take on these roles or are afraid of the simplification because of the risk of making decisions, because those risks are not, you know, some companies are more risk adverse. So whether a company can manage to be flat, also we need, I think, to take into consideration how risk adverse they are, and what the reward system is to retain people that want to get advanced, where there's no more layers. And how do we make sure we're telling the story of taking risks so that it's successful versus something people don't want to do as they're making decisions as leaders. So I just wanted to add that thought.
Thank you. The incentives as well. Yeah, risk and the incentive side of it, because there may not be adequate incentive to take the risk, right? To stick your neck out there may not be worth it. Okay, I don't see any more hands. Okay, so the second, or tie actually, was, can design thinking succeed in your organization? And that was one where there was a couple tools there, assessing readiness and then contrasting design thinking and managerial thinking was the phrase used. Can someone who voted for that tell us what was provoking or helpful about that article? Thank you, Anna, yes. You're on mute. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about that. I do believe that the fact that this article was talking about readiness, that is really the cornerstone for that type of change, but for any change in general. And the fact that it was providing specific areas that we need to pay attention to, by providing specific questions and so on, that really helped a lot. But at the same time, it really showcases and compares how design thinking can really change the elements of the organization itself, and to what extent the organization will be always prepared to take that step. Because a lot of times we get into design thinking, I've seen that in my work, because it's really a buzzword. I mean, everyone wants really to have that in their organization, and they're not prepared at all. So I like the fact that it talked about the readiness and also the required preparedness for the executives and the staff in order to move into that. That's the element that really stood out for me.
Thank you. Someone else have something to add on that one?
I just want to tag on to what Anna said. I love that. And
I loved that the article talked about what to do to be ready, because I've read too many things that are like, you're not ready. And then they just leave you high and dry, right? And consultants too, like, well, you're not ready for my brilliance, so too bad. So I loved that this article was like, you're not ready, but here are the things you can do to leverage it and get ready. So I really appreciated that about this article.
I did as well, and what I'll add on, and then full disclosure, this is a topic near and dear to my heart. I trained at IDEO in design thinking, and I'm also a trained user experience designer, so I'm always thinking about how to integrate design overall to everything. Something, and so I've worked with design teams, and something that is implied but not stated in that article that I think is important is he talked about the concept of the design lab and being successful. The ones that seem to be successful are the ones where they really invest in a digital asset system. All design may not be digital, but it's going to have some component. And so the design labs or design functions or capabilities that work on reusable code components and templates and branding, and you know, it may not be the most exciting thing in the world, but that's what makes them sustainable and moves them forward. And so, and you can see that as a consumer. You know, Shopify is recognized in the industry for their asset library. IBM is, Apple is, obviously. That kind of a capability is really important. And he didn't actually say that, but that was my only criticism. Otherwise, I thought the same thing you did. I thought it was a really good overview. And the perspective was helpful in addition to what you just mentioned around, you know, readiness and what you would actually do about it. Who else on that one?
What I liked about it was, well, thought was interesting was back in the day, it seemed like the folks who were talking about design thinking, unlike Eugene, the way you just articulated it, back in the day, it seemed like a lot of folks bringing that into the companies I worked in were, you know, in the innovation space or were trying to, you know, come up with new ways of doing things. Whereas it feels like this was applying it more to your organization and how you do work. And I think the readiness piece really jumps out to me because, you know, that takes empowering folks, getting the right folks in the room to think and work and come up with ideas that way. And that requires a certain, you know, type of leadership, empowering them to do so. And I think that's super critical for how we do, how I like to do org design work. So I like that about it.
Very good point. And the risk and rewards that Carol mentioned apply there too, right? To be able to
Absolutely.
step up and
Yeah.
take the applies everywhere. Margaret, did you have a
Yeah,
add-on?
I had one thought. It's really kind of a question. In reading that article, you know, comparing the you know, more traditional managerial style where the focus is on ROI and such, and you know, different kinds of structures and processes, you know, it just seems the two are so not compatible. And I think the you know, traditional management styles kind of rule the corporate world. And I just thought, wow, that's going to be hard to reconcile. And they made some good recommendations, but I think, you know, getting someone who's really from that world to, you know, to just to accept this other process or to accept the results, the outcomes of the process, when it doesn't quite align with, you know, how they've been working and thinking their whole careers. I was just curious if anyone has run into that or if there is kind of a, well, this is, you know, this is how it works. Because I just thought it's almost like, I don't say irreconcilable, but they, when you know, if someone's really in that mindset, you know, and it's kind of hard, you know, I would think to break them out. So I was just curious if anyone had any other insights on that aspect of it.
Maybe Selena does. She raised her hand. If not, then go ahead with what you're going to, and then we'll come back to Margaret's question.
Well, I raised my hand before, so
Yeah.
it wasn't specific to that. But I think it's a really good question, Margaret. You know, I was looking at this. I have these like pads of paper where I do like my mind maps and everything. And I was at AbbVie for a time. Don't tell anyone I have this pad of paper. And they do all of this like design thinking worksheets that they take to everybody, and they do like design thinking workshops where they would bring this thinking to different organizations, even the compliance organization. And so I thought it was really neat, but when intentional focus kind of was lost on it, like there would be like a little bit of a vibe, then it would just kind of trail off. And so I think that like really integrating and making it a sustainable practice is really important. Is like the one thing that I was thinking about while you were talking. But my comment before that, I was thinking, gosh, isn't design thinking such a magical thing to tie up with like AI adoption and readiness? Because like if we're going to try to bring more creative thinking and like navigating complexity and decision making with AI, like design thinking goes really well with that. So I think there's like an opportunity to sort of integrate it more. And I was curious what all your thoughts were on that, especially Jim. I know you're thinking a lot about about AI and everything. So
So we have two questions out there. We have Margaret's question around how to reconcile that more so between the two different perspectives, and then Selena's question around where's the opportunity, where's the best opportunity, I guess. And Ramona has her hand up, so we'll hold those two questions and see what you'd like to add.
My thinking when Margaret was speaking was that I meet that a lot because I work with people who are very much ego driven. And design thinking is about as a principle, you're part of something that no longer belongs to you as an author that will be published and get the I don't know what prize for it, you know? So the way I try to work around that is to support the transition to more of a team approach. So in order to maybe easily get into maybe not name them design thinking processes or projects, but use the tools, not necessarily naming them, and working around the setting of teams rather than a hierarchical setting. Also, finding what's the common interest or the common opportunity. The common problem, you know, people open up a little bit, and then you can actually introduce, or at least that's how it's a little bit like a Trojan horse, you know. That's it's not, I always have ethical conversation about it with myself, extended ethical conversations. But then I try to explain it. So actually, what you just experienced. Is this. And actually, if you do it properly, it would look like this. And then maybe in the best case scenario, they go, oh, tell us more. Maybe next time we try the real thing, let's say. And I loved your idea about Selena, about the AI opportunity, because maybe in settings where there is this rigidity, if you raise the curiosity for how AI is going to impact you in a maybe more positive way rather than killing us or I don't know going against us, I agree with you. I think we could work around that idea. Thank you.
Thanks, Ramona. Larry, you have your hand up.
Response to Margaret as well. I think this is a senior leadership paradigm change that may need to take place because so many of the traditional management things you talk about, the profitability, the quarterly reports, key performance indicators, all those things that are typical tend to be task oriented and associated with profitability. And organizations do need money because the old statement, no margin, no mission, is true. So money becomes the oxygen supply to the company. They have to have it in order to exist, but it is not the reason that the company exists. Most companies, I mean, the only businesses I know that are in business to make money is the Department of Treasury and counterfeiters. They're in business to make money, right? But everybody else, we're in business to serve our customers. And the paradigm shift that has to occur is about that very essence. What is our core purpose? It's about the mission of the organization. And you can spend 6 months working with the senior leaders to get them to begin to change their paradigm that money, yes, is important, and all those other management principles are important, but so are these things over here. And that's where we begin to build into the design function more the human side of things. But that, again, that's a 6 month or longer process with the senior managers.
Jim, did you have something to add?
Yeah, also back to Margaret's point, but also linking to what Ramona said earlier, is if you look at their table of design thinking principles, and you think of those as principles and not how am I going to operationalize the practices that will do that, what you discover is that the purpose, collaboration, work style is different for different parts of the organization. So you would say the best way that the financial accounting department can drive cost is to have the least expensive financial recording and reporting system available with no defects ever. We don't want you to do experiments and fail in finance. We want you to follow rigor when you do things. Opposite culture of that in your product design and customer service, it is more that we want you to experiment with different ways of satisfying this target customer for it. So the principles work. What this has a very high sort of lean on is the design organization. It's your R&D lab, your innovation lab, the people who work there, not the people who are responsible for getting zero defect medicines off the end of the production line at 1 million pills an hour. That's a whole different world for applying it. So I like the article because it got to it both. It took the principles, but it also gave you a structure in the assessment questions that allows you to think about that in terms of the so that. So the organization encourages work in cross-functional teams so that what? The organization is informal and flexible so that what? And that so that what changes depending on what part of the organization and what the type of the company is that you're working with. So I thought as was pointed out, I think Janina pointed out, it does take you from theory to practice to assessment of readiness. And that I think is design thinking in itself for organization design.
I'll add a perspective across all three of your comments. Margaret's question around how do you actually make it happen? Ramona's point about you're giving away authorship or ownership was how you put it, and then the point you just made, Jim, about getting pills off the line. A couple other design communities. I was at an event, and eight out of 10 people I talked to were complaining about not having a seat at the table. So I thought, okay, let me find the two that aren't complaining. And the two that aren't complaining did exactly what all of you just said. They would take the problem that wasn't the most exciting thing, getting pills off the line. They didn't stick to the ownership of it. They just made sure they solved the problem, and then they drew attention. Then they were obviously there. So then that kind of took care of it and moved things along. To the extent that some of the other points that all of you made around it has to be, they have to be receptive to it. But that attitude and perspective and willingness to dig in. Made a distinction in that particular population. Does anyone have anything else to add on that article? Otherwise, we'll move on. No? Okay. Watched all the hands. All right. Then our third place one was the types of stories leaders need to tell. There's just different sorts of ways that you like the article said, giving away a piece of yourself, different ways to do that to be authentic. And to help people relate to you. So, same question. If we have someone on who voted for that one, be great if you could start us off. or any, if you, even if you didn't, any comments in general?
I guess I'll start. I found where my mentor got this thinking that he passed on to us as his own. The five stories, I have a PowerPoint slide of the five stories, and they read almost exactly the way they were portrayed in this article. And it really does work. Our organization design practice starts with vivid images of the idealized future state and then works backwards. And that the vision story, they make the unseen future feel vivid and real, inspiring a shared vision. So you can sort out who's on board and who's not on board when you're creating that vision. The ones that are just stand by looking at all the post-its go on the wall, they're probably not completely on board. And the others are going to lead out. So I think it was quite reinforcing the way that it was written and the content to simplify this idea of the stories. Great reminder to me for something from 20 plus years ago.
Simplify and identify. So then when you see something working, you can articulate it, I think, is what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Carol, you have a comment on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I just coming from working for a global communications company, so a lot of the storytelling was what they did for clients, but they also just did a merger, and I saw what was not done in terms of storytelling, and I appreciated that. You know, I think leaders know that they need to do storytelling, but to break down the types of storytelling for what type of action is critical. But assuming that, I think it's a skill that is not often people are trained on to really understand. They think that their story is going to work for everything, but there are different stories for different outcomes. And it shows up a lot when there are mergers and acquisitions to bring people along in different ways, not only the values, but what are the actions and what are you trying to transform? So I feel like there's a missing link when we talk about organizational transformation and mergers and acquisitions to train leaders to tell the right stories in the right ways to the right audiences versus just telling them storytelling is important. So I love getting further into the conversation.
Yeah, you're bringing up a really good point that occurred to me reading this. I mean, obviously it's the authenticity, right? It has to be, you know, something real that you can point to, and that might be harder to do. I wanted to ask this group, can you think of anything in your experience where you worked with someone or saw something that was a really good story? I can share mine, but I'm interested if anybody had something that stuck in their experience around a really good storytelling leader. I'll share mine while you're thinking. His name is Mike Cotton. You can look him up. And I worked with him, Humana healthcare company. And he is one of 13 kids all adopted. And so his family, obviously, you know, they had to, you know, some patching of things together to, you know, raise 13 kids and have all the means. So when he talked about, you know, resources and customer service, people listened. it was very powerful and very authentic, and it worked. So he's the best example that I can think of where you found a really, you know, Carol, good point. You know, you got to be authentic and believable in whatever the story is. And so then that made me think of, okay, the context matters, because he could tell that story in another environment and it wouldn't be as powerful, you know, if you weren't in a service environment. So that was my question for the group, if anybody has a similar observation or experience.
Yeah, I can recollect when I think Amazon, when Jeff Bezos' company, and I don't even know that the name was Amazon at the time, was recruiting additional people for that company that he was developing, he had us do a 5, 10, and 20 year vision for the organization. And he told a story, and he opened it with, "We're not building a bookstore. we're building an information transaction, retail transaction processing capability that is going to serve hundreds and hundreds of stores. And he went on to describe how that would flow, and he gave the full 20-year vision in about 15 minutes to these people. You could hear a pin drop in the room. And he said, "Who wants to come with me?" And people hurt themselves getting out of their chairs to say they wanted to go with him. And it was the perfect story at the right time. And it was, and that vision was only half baked. And it evolved, but not by much.
And did he have a so he's telling the story about his vision. Did he have a compelling reason why he thought that? I kind of always wondered that because I read an article that talking about he just thought that that would be a good place to start. I mean, he envisioned the whole thing, but he thought books were something that would be a way to get off your training wheels. Was there any of the anything he related to personally in there that you recall?
Not in that speech, but I was told that when he went on a trip with Larry Ellison and Warren Buffett to China, and on that trip, anecdotally, it was reported that he told the story of how books were the cohesive point of his family. That aunts, uncles, they were all teachers. And everybody, when they got together, they didn't talk politics, they didn't talk TV shows. They talked about the books that they had read and the authors and the stories of the authors behind them. And so he had a personal relationship with books. And they were not re books are not readily available to people. Typically, if you don't have a car, you can't get to a bookstore in most of America. And so he wanted to put the store and distribute the store to the bring the store to the people, not the people to the store.
Okay, great. Yeah, I figured there. Well, that is aligned with the conversation so far around having a good story. Dardina, your hand is up, and then Ramona, maybe you can tell us about the book you linked us to after
Oh,
Dardina
cool.
comments.
So two things. One, that was a great example, Jim, because it ties in with what I was about to say, which is not all stories start with Once Upon a Time, right? Like his story about his first story was really not a story like we think of it traditionally, but he still wove a story with an arc. Then the one about him connecting with books with his family, that's more of like a traditional kind of story. So I think you can still have a story even if it's not when I was a kid, right? It doesn't have to start with Once Upon a Time. I think the other thing to be aware of with stories that we didn't really touch on is bad stories spread too, right? So you have to be aware of when you're creating some corporate, I call it corporate folklore, that is now a story that you didn't mean to share, right? So things that people get punished for is the one, like then everyone else now knows that story.
Makes
Thank
sense.
you. That's it.
Thank you. Ramona, tell us about the book you linked us to, if you would.
It's an interesting book because it talks both about the essence of storytelling, which is the search for meaning, essentially. That's why we need to tell ourselves stories, to find meaning on a personal level. It talks about the idea of community. Stories were born when language came up in order to make meaning of what was going on with the people around, the lives of people, and so on. When I read the article, I had the same thought about Kurt Vonnegut. I highly recommend it too. I double, triple Gina's recommendation. In there, you will find the how to tell a story. What are the patterns in a story? Because it's interesting if it's the prince who gets saved by the princess or the reverse. Or does everybody die in the end? Is it a happy end or a suspended end? Is it a twist in the story? And so on. I'm always mindful that the storytelling thing it is associated, it's like the new pink in town, you know, and everybody likes to wear it. It's like very trendy. If we think how storytelling appeared in the caves, there was not everybody was a storyteller, and that was fine because it is a talent that can be cultivated. Authenticity you cannot train. Ability to be empathetic or to present yourself with empathy towards the others in your storytelling, it's not something very mechanical or structural, or you get a degree on it, I think. So in terms of we need to teach leaders to do this and how it is important, let's make sure this doesn't turn into something very mechanistic. And it loses, in fact, the essence. If you don't have a story, don't try to have one. It's okay. Not everybody has a story. It's fine. You will live, and we will live if you're not trying to tell us something that is not authentic. That was my point.
Yeah,
thank
not
you.
In the right place or time. Thank you for that, and thank you for the affirmation on the Vonnegut thing. That's only 2 minutes. I mean, I thought that's some of the most useful 2 minutes you can possibly spend if you're a reader or an author. The way he articulated it, and like you said, you know, who dies in the end or whatever. We have a couple more articles, so let's do that. Unless anyone's got anything else they'd like to add on the types of stories. That one apart. Okay. The next one after that was storytelling and organization design. That was a Naomi's article from a few years ago. She surfaced some things. One was a parable, I think you call it. And then she had a couple other stories there. And I didn't get a chance to read them all. I read yesterday and I thought, well, good grief. I didn't know I'd have five more things to do. So I didn't get a chance to read her links yet. But if anybody did, that'd be great. Any comments on that? Or just how to apply it in general. I mean, maybe the story is not personal. Maybe the story is about the change of the organization or the journey of the organization, like Jim shared with us around the original concept for Amazon. Mark?
Yeah, I think what jumped out to me here was we've been talking about, you know, leaders and using storytelling. And I love Jardine. The why I think is important before saying, hey, just go learn this or try this out. Really know why you're doing it to be authentic, whatever. But I think from an org design perspective, whether it's whole scale change or larger groups or involvement strategies, if you will, I think helping create the story, you know, with the folks who are in the system doing the work is really powerful. So that might be taken a little bit further from an org design perspective. I mean, Wiseboard, she quotes Wiseboard here in a different context, but I think he used to talk a lot about like the scenes in the movie, you know, where are you or what movie do you want to create, whatever. It goes back to the vision thing. But I think even if it's not fully, you know, a completed story yet, those folks who are doing the design work can start creating their own story and then make it even more authentic when they're going out trying to help explain it to others what they're trying to do. So that's what I got out of this from Naomi.
I thought so too, to add on. It was a nice reminder. And some of you also have mentioned that with other things. It was a nice reminder. You do need to put a story around it, you know, the change and the other thing, you know, what you're trying to do. And sometimes you can get in a hurry to get things done. You know, no matter what your intentions are, you still get in a hurry and maybe forget that. So I thought it was a nice reminder. Does anyone have anything else to add on that?
A little process thing is that I said earlier, we start with an idealized vision of the future state. And the point made here about have the audience create the story. So I don't create that story. The co-design team creates that story of the idealized future state. As you practice that and you begin to understand, as a facilitator and as a silent coach, you begin to understand firmly held beliefs and biases that people hold. as they write the story, they negotiate the story, and they present the story. And that's extremely helpful, because then you can bring those biases and firmly held beliefs that are no longer going to be true, or that are no longer true now. And you can bring them in the next two stages of the design process. And so you can put them in as risks, for example. You can blend them into a risk assessment, and you can blend them into the capabilities required to operate in that future state. So what are the biases? You know, for example, if we're going to transform from the lowest cost customer service provider to the premium provider, 90% of our agents will have to go. That's a bias that people brought into that process. Nobody had to go. Not only that, but the Spanish-speaking people taught Spanish to the non-Spanish-speaking people after work every night, because they were inspired by wanting to work in that future state where they could learn English and they could teach what they knew. Now, interestingly enough, there's like 27 Spanish dialects that are just in Southern California, but that's beside the point. It really works. So that process, I do repeat, it takes practice to observe the people working in small groups and documenting the biases that are being brought to that thinking, into that story, and then counteracting those in facilitation without actually confronting anybody. Let them discover that the bias is not helpful, or the belief is just not sustainable in the future state.
That's a good way to close. There's some saying, isn't it, the winners write history or the victors write history or something. Something like that applies to stories also. So nice way to wrap us up. I think we are right at time, I believe. So I will ask Tanya if we have any reminders. Otherwise, we will. Oh, Ramona, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I cannot. This is going to be, I don't know, a commercial time. 1 minute. Okay. On 22 and 23 of March next year, if you want to come to Bucharest, there's this wonderful event called The Power of Storytelling. I will put a link in the chat in a minute. Look at it. I cannot not recommend it. It's a project I love dearly. I used to be a part of it at some point. I will probably support it next year. It's the 10th anniversary. Hopefully you'll call me saying that we are going to meet each other in Bucharest in March. Thank you.
That's a great commercial. Thank you. Nice holiday send-off. Really appreciate that. Thanks so much.
That is looking forward to 2025. It's amazing to think it's already here. This is our last event for 2024. So we very much appreciate everybody's time and energy being here to support your fellow community members. Gina, thank you for stepping up and helping to facilitate today's discussion. It went really well, and we are loving seeing the increased number of attendees and participation in this particular offering. So thank you all very much for your time. We have sent out the announcement about our 2025 conference and registration being open. So we'll have more content that we'll be sharing at the beginning of the year about additional speakers, because I'm gathering all of that information from our peer led sessions that are have just been invited and formally accepted from their proposals. So be on the lookout for that once 2025 gets started, as well as our other virtual events. So I wish everyone a great rest of your 2024 and a happy and warm holiday season. If you have any questions, I'm happy to stay on the line and answer anything about the community before we wrap up.
I will as well. Thank you all so much. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Everyone.